This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today we engage in a little urban exploration through the lens of an urbex photographer who has turned the detritus of modern life into art. But that's later in the program. First, we meet Charlotte's new police chief, Kerr Putney. Chief Putney rose through the ranks at CMPD and takes over for Rodney Monroe, who recently retired and who made lots of changes in the department when he arrived here from Richmond, Virginia. What is Chief Putney's vision for the department? We explore that and other public safety topics for most of this hour. Chief Putney, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the invitation.
Nice to have you here. You've risen to the top like cream, I suppose, at a time when police departments around the country face increased scrutiny because of things that have gone wrong. Why did you want this job?
I've been asked that question a lot. I think the big thing is Charlotte is home, and I think I have the deepest knowledge and the I think I can hit the ground running, and as we have as a team, and I thought the time was right.
And you've been in this job for 16 days now, because you took over July 1st.
Oh, long time, long 16 days.
Mark. Yeah. How has it been?
It's been awesome. Really, the support from Charlotte community and the organization internally has been just awesome.
Great. Charlotte has not had the kind of attention that we've seen with other police departments around the country. Is that because we were lucky or because of something we did or didn't do as a police force or that Chief Monroe did or didn't do as a police chief? To what do you attribute the relative calm here and at least no incidents like we've witnessed elsewhere?
Sure, I'd give the credit to the community, Charlotte community.
Why?
Because mainly what I've seen over the last 16 days is a community that's always proactive, looking to take steps and be courageous and talk about conversations, race in particular, that a lot of other areas are not as willing to do. And then not only talk, but they also take action. There's a lot of moving parts that have been put into motion based on the initial conversations around race here in Charlotte.
You may have only been chief for 16 days, but you've been with the force for what, 23 years?
23 years, correct.
That's a long time.
That's dog years in police
work. Have we always been this good at what we do, or have we gotten better recently?
We have not always been this good. It started in the 90s when there were a lot of shootings that we were involved in, our police department was involved in, of unarmed black males in particular. And then from that, there was a Citizens Review Board that came into play. There were dash cams, a talk with a community building initiative founded by the Foundation of Carolinas, a lot of conversation. There was a homicide task force. There were a lot of things that came into play at that time that put race at the forefront. We nibbled at the edges at that point, and now we're really starting to take huge bites and digest the fact that we have some work to do in this area.
Of course, we did have the incident recently, a couple of years ago now, although the trial starts, I think, Monday, of an unarmed person. Jonathan Farrell was shot and killed by a police officer. This all happened before you were chief and before we witnessed the rash of police on citizen violence that we've seen around the country. What impact do you think those other incidents might have on this trial?
Well, what people are doing, what we see and have in our assessment of Ferguson and Baltimore, there are a lot of outside people who want to come in and wreak havoc, to be quite frank with you, and in those cities. And what we're trying to do is prevent that from happening here. And the initial conversations have been with people here who care about the city, who can help us determine who those outsiders are so that we can let them understand we're more than willing to facilitate their ability to talk and get their message across, but we're not going to tolerate them crossing the line and engaging in criminal behavior.
Officer Randall Carrick's trial starts, I think, Monday, July 20th. He was charged with involuntary manslaughter. He faces 11 years in prison. We've had some nonviolent protests and gatherings on this topic surrounding this incident. What have you and the police department done, and what are you continuing to do to ensure that things stay peaceful during this trial, no matter the outcome?
I'd like to tell you everything we've done, but it's so many things. I'll just hit on the top three or four, one of which is training our people, educating our officers, hearts and minds, I keep saying, because this time, unlike the DNC, where we had a lot of protests, we're going to be the target this time. We weren't in 2012. So making sure our people are more thick-skinned and have a deeper understanding of what we're going to face. The other big thing is been reaching out to any and everybody who wants to come in and assist with this, NAACP, Safe Coalition of North Carolina, the clergy, the local clergy here. And what I keep being blown away with is their ability and their willingness to step in and support us, have these conversations, meet with the millennial leadership, and talk about how to do this the Charlotte way, which is peaceful.
So how will, if a large protest group gathers, how will they be handled?
What we're going to do is facilitate their message, let them get their message out. We're going to help them if they want to march. We're going to do what we did a lot. It's the DNC model. We're going to help them get their message out and do it legally and keep it in that realm.
I have to say that the DNC, the police actions during the DNC were remarkable in how they were handled and the end result, which was nothing. I mean, there was no violence. There was no problem. People got their message out.
Yes.
At least I think they felt that they got their message out. Did you learn that from the DNC, or did we invent those methods during the DNC?
It's organic. I mean, that was the plan from the beginning. Chief Monroe and the rest of the team were talking through it, and that's kind of the vision for it. And then what we saw was people began to trust that we truly were there to facilitate them getting their message out. Mm-hmm. We'd have a lot of conversations with the leadership of various protest groups, and they believed that we were going to do what we said we were going to do. And now we understand that our job is really to be guardians of those civil liberties, and that's exactly the model we're going to use moving forward.
Since you are making plans for this and you've met with civic leaders and you're bringing other people into this,
sure.
If Officer Carrick is acquitted and there is some sort of protest because of that acquittal, who is involved in handling the crowds aside from CMPD? What other organizations, civic leaders, etc., might be on the scene?
Well, we have a lot of them. I mentioned many of them already, the clergy, NAACP.
Right.
But we also have the Sheriff's Department, which is a strong partner, the Fire Department, which is a strong partner. We've reached out to all the local agencies in the region, and SHP. What we expect to do is allow people to get their voice out there and heard. And what we see is a lot of times that diffuses and de-escalates the situation, which is always our goal.
And the police department has been working with the North Carolina Barbers Association several of events called Cops and Barbers Town Hall meetings. What comes out of those meetings? Who do you see in the? Who comes to those meetings? What are you hearing in those meetings?
Let me step back first, Mike. The big thing is people talk about the town hall, but it's the day before, the evening before, where we let the kids and cops go to dinner together and just connect on a human level. That is the moving part. The second day, the momentum carries over, and it's a town hall. You ask who's coming. The kids and cops, the first evening, mm-hmm. to connect, and some of those relationships continue. And then the second day, we're hoping to get kids out, but mostly it's adults coming to express their concerns around these police and community encounters and give us some feedback about how they're perceived and quite frankly, how they feel. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is based around fear and misunderstanding.
How do they feel?
They feel fearful.
Of the police?
Many do. But what we hear, though, is that what we accomplish, though, is we talk about our expectations. And I love the dialogue between Sean Corbett of the Barbers Association and our captain, because our captain is explaining to the public what we do, how we see it, and why, mm-hmm. and what our expectations are. And then we hear from Sean Corbett how that can be perceived. So what we see is in the middle is how we should all be connecting, and our officers should be articulating the message, what our expectations are, why we stopped them in the first place, mm-hmm. and the public should understand that we're there to do a job. So what I see is that exchange, which is quite organic, and it gives everybody a deeper understanding of how those transactions should take place.
Are most of the people who come to these meetings, particularly the young people who come to these meetings, are they mostly African-American males?
Yes. Well, no. Unfortunately, no. What we see is the dinner, and we're intentional about that, is mostly African-American males. But the town hall is much more open and is generally an older crowd.
So what does that tell you, that you have to have dinner with African-American males?
Well, what it tells me is we have to connect with people that we engage with anyway, but we have to do it proactively and do it when well before it's a traffic stop or a pedestrian stop where we're having these encounters that then escalate because of misunderstanding.
Are they the ones that are most fearful of the police, or does fear of the police cross racial and economic boundaries?
Mostly that is the demographic. And I won't say just fear. There's some anger there because they've seen encounters go bad, not just here in Charlotte, but across the country. And anything that happens in policing, whatever hits you across the country hits you locally. And a lot of that perception comes to bear in any engagement that we have with that demographic.
You're African-American. Are you from Charlotte?
Yes, sir.
So you grew up in this community. You've obviously seen the incidents of police around. I'm sorry.
Let me. Yes, sir. I am African American.
Yeah.
No, I'm not originally from Charlotte.
Okay.
I've been here since '89.
Okay, but you grew up in America, so you witnessed these incidents.
Sure.
I'm sure in your neighborhood.
Sure.
You've certainly seen them on television in recent months. You know there is a feeling among young black men that they are being unfairly targeted, that they are being unfairly treated by police once they are. Stopped at a traffic light or whatever it may be. Why is that happening?
Well, you ask, do I understand it? Have I experienced it? Yes, hit me in my household, actually. My dad was my hero. He had some encounters that I saw that affected me, and I would flash back to 8 years old. So I can understand deeply and personally how that impacts a lot of our black males. But moving forward, what we're trying to do is say we understand, give our people an understanding of it so that there's some empathy in those contacts. What was the second part of your question?
I was just saying, why does it happen? What do you say to these young people?
Well, it happens because our people are going to do their job. We have, and again, we keep talking about the outliers, the people who might misbehave and mistreat people, but the vast majority of our people are doing heroic work. I can give you examples. Officer Evett and Proctor over in Hickory Grove Division, who constantly and daily are engaging with young black kids in particular in positive ways that never hits the airwaves.
But we do hear about young men, young African-American men, essentially being victimized of driving while black, walking while black, shopping while black. They haven't done anything wrong. They just happen to be black. So I'm just trying to get to the nugget of, because you have a different perspective.
Sure.
You're not only a police officer, you're black.
Right.
Why does this continue to happen?
Well, what I can tell you is, just like I said before, we're assuming that the reason for the contact is based on race. And I challenge that thought.
What is it based on, if not race?
Most of the time, from my experience, and we have statistical data to back this up, it is because there's an articulable reason for that contact, meaning you're driving and your tag is expired, your windows are tinted too dark. There are a lot of reasons for the initial contact. But from my perspective, when I was engaging in my early 20s and so forth with officers, I always flash back to when I was 8 and I perceived that my race was one of the determining factors.
Okay.
And I see that playing out now in a lot of our black male youth.
But if an officer is driving down the street and they see a bunch of African-American kids with baggy pants standing on the corner, are they more likely to give them the once-over, maybe even stop and talk to them, than if they were driving through Ballantyne and saw a bunch of white kids standing on the corner talking?
Well, what I can tell you is that's a good question, Mike. Kind of hard to answer directly with any depth, because what I have to do is dig into the data. And what I see is when our officers are driving through predominantly black neighborhoods encountering black youth, it's because they've been directed to do so. I would have it no other way. I want us engaging in areas that we see crime. A lot of the calls for service dictate where we go. So I want them to be proactive. If there's a call for service and there's a high likelihood a call for service is in a geographical area that happens to be predominantly black, then they're going to encounter mostly black people. However, I want to make sure, though, when we look at that data, it overlays that way. If it doesn't, if most of the people we're stopping in Ballantyne are black, then we have other concerns to address.
Charlotte's new police chief, Kerr Putney, is our guest. We'll have to take a break. We're coming right back with more of our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Restaurant Week. Tomorrow through the 26th, over 120 fine dining establishments will offer three-course prefix dinners. Menus and reservations at charlotterestaurantweek.com. Well, the Harvey B. Gantt Center becomes the nexus of art and activism this weekend when two exhibitions open there. The group Afro-Cobra dates back to 1968 Chicago, and the exhibit Afro-Cobra Now reveals their shifting aesthetic over 40 years. Meanwhile, Intergalactic Soul was created by two local guys. And although vastly different, their works are also infused with social and political undertones, and we'll hear about them both when we get together tomorrow at 9.
On the next Day in Ream show, millions of Americans regularly take over-the-counter medicines for minor aches and pains, but the FDA now warns some of these drugs can be dangerous. Risks and benefits of non-prescription pain relief medications.
Join the Diane Ream Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Kerr Putney. He's the chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, been on the job for 23 years, but been police chief for 16 days. What attracted you to the job as a policeman in the first place, day one?
Well, Mike, nothing. That's the truth of it. I did not want to be a cop. Never liked
them. Really?
I never liked them. Again, based on my experience when I was a kid, a number of experiences, but the one at 8-year-olds really sticks out when my dad was arrested by the cops in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, my hometown. Never cared for him. He was my hero. Not saying he was not in the wrong, because he was. But so what? That was my hero.
That's right.
And it was the way it was handled. And that's what I tell people. The nuance is I've locked up people who are thanking me after the fact. So you can do it right. I've also locked up some people who didn't care for me and probably still don't. But it's the way in which you do it. And I know, though, that and again, the reason I'm passionate about it is I know that impact, because a lot of times, even now, when the blue lights go off, I flash back to when I was 8 initially, and then my rational brain takes over, and I know, hey, it's probably not going to be a big deal.
So if you didn't like cops, didn't want to be a cop, how did you become a cop?
Well, best friend, a college friend of mine who was also a black male, was the first black kid I ever knew who grew up wanting to be a cop. And he applied. It was the Charlotte Police Department at the time. They denied him. I was already working for the county county police department, which was separate from the city at the time, mm-hmm. with their security division as an officer. And I'd already gone through BLET. They denied him. And I said, you know what?
What is BLET?
Basic law enforcement training.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I was already certified by the state. And I said, okay, they turned you down. I'm thinking because of race, because, again, I have that flashback to when I was 8. I said, watch this. I applied. And I applied like in April. They started me in the academy in August, and I fell in love with the job probably week 2 of the academy.
Why?
Because it was the structure I needed at the time. I was a 23-year-old know-it-all. I had a criminal justice degree, and I was going to solve the problems of policing, especially those around race.
Is part of the problem that we've seen around the country with young police officers the fact that some people are attracted to this job because they like the idea that they have a badge and a gun?
I think so. I think, though, what we're trying to do now and being intentional about it moving forward, which is why we have some of our community members looking at our process, is how can we better recruit people who have their heart in the right place coming in? And I'll be honest with you, it's a journey, though, because I didn't initially. I came in with a huge, well, I won't say chip, it's more like a boulder on my shoulder. Mm. And I wanted to show that I was as good, if not better, than most cops. And what I saw was a lot of heroes who worked beside me, who I had to depend on for, you know, my safety. And regardless of their color, they took the oath seriously, and that impressed me. So I think a lot of the people we're trying to recruit now, though, might come in here with a different perspective, thinking that it's cowboys and Indians kind mm-hmm. of thing, when in essence it's really us being guardians of civil liberties and trying to make sure people are safe at night.
I was going to ask you, if your heart's in the right place, where is it?
Right now, mm-hmm. or when I can.
If you're an officer,
in general,
in general, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you're serving something greater than yourself. I'm gonna be honest, and it's a journey for me, because when I came in, it was all about me, Mike. It was. I was coming in to prove a point, and what I saw quickly is people were serving something and taking an oath to something greater than themselves. There's a lot of self-sacrifice, and they were doing it willingly, and that inspired me. I really did. It connected with you at a level, and it shocked me, to be quite frank. I'd never seen cops at that level. Mm-hmm. I'd never had that understanding and a communication and a conversation with them like that, and I was blown away. To this day, I still have instances where it hits me like that.
If you're on the street as an officer, you're facing danger around every corner. You never know where it's going to come from or when it's going to hit. And along with that, it would seem to me, despite your training, you're a human being, there's a certain level of fear. How much of what we're seeing around the country right now is officers reacting to that fear, that primal fear?
Well, what I can tell you, Mike, is fear is instinctive. It keeps us alive. And we have to try to train you so that you can manage it. And that's a part of what we do educationally. So I think when fear overrides your training and sometimes even your capacity and ability, you have tragic outcomes. Mm-hmm. But the other big thing, though, is, I mean, we talk about fear, but that's layered on top of some implicit biases that we come to work with. And we can't help that. And what we're trying to do, too, is do work intentionally to root that out, make sure people are aware that it exists so that we can mitigate for it. And again, though, I can't harp enough. We got to get back to having these connections before there's an encounter that goes negative so that people see us on a human level. They see us as people who are there to be guardians and not warriors. And we know then we can de-escalate a situation because our intent going in is not just to come in and effect an arrest, but it is also to de-escalate a situation and bring calm to the reason that they're calling us to any call for service in the first place.
Young people make mistakes, and a lot of those mistakes come from a lack of guidance on the part of adults in their lives. We've had this stance probably since the Nixon administration of getting tough on crime.
Sure.
Did it work? Are we too tough on crime sometimes?
Well, did it work? There's sufficient data to show that it didn't. I think we went overboard sometimes. Three strikes legislation in particular had some very significant negative consequences. Also, acting like every crime is a crime that needs the police action. And again, that was a mistake looking back, but we don't have the benefit of hindsight when we're just establishing those laws. But we need to be, just like we're being right now, intentional and thoughtful about how we reassess those things.
Are we too quick to incarcerate as opposed to rehabilitate? And does incarceration result in any sort of rehabilitation?
Well, it depends. I mean, one of the best drug treatment programs that is in this region is at the Mecklenburg County Jail. So sometimes it can help. Mm-hmm. However, if you're thinking you're going to lock people away and throw away the key on most of just any random felony, then, yeah, you're going to have negative consequences. And at the end, the outcome's going to be worse than the initial arrest. So sometimes it doesn't work. But so let's don't make no mistake, like Richard Pryor, there's a reason for prison, and some people belong there. And we want to get the right people there, the habitual criminal long-term offenders are the people that we want to put behind bars for a long time.
Charlotte Police Chief Kerr Putney is our guest. If you have questions of him, we want to hear from you. We have about 10 more minutes left with him before he has to go to another appointment. So what questions do you have? You can reach us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. What's your take on the war on drugs? We've begun in this country to have a conversation about its effectiveness. What's your take on it?
War on drugs, the interesting thing is, again, when it was established, I understand it. It was the height of and the highest point of the crack epidemic. There was a lot of violence, assault weapons, and everything else. And I understand it. It was a quick reaction and legislation that established long-term sentences for crack dealers and so forth. So I understand it, especially to curb the violence. The issue, though, is when we are not willing to assess, and now we're finally starting to, that long-term negative impact, you got to balance it. And again, the system's not perfect, but I think we're being a bit more thoughtful now and revisiting some of those 80s and 90s laws that really hurt us more than helped us.
But we have several of these mandatory sentencing laws which put people in jail for fairly minor levels of possession or use and even selling, I suppose. And it seems that if you look at the prison population in this country, which is enormous, when you take a look at it per capita against any other Western nation, it's enormous and it's predominantly minority.
Yes, it is. There's a disparate impact.
What does that say?
Well, it says a lot of things, one of which is we have to, again, be thoughtful and intentional about what we want those outcomes to be. Now, again, make no mistake, if you're a career criminal and this is your way of life and there's a lot of violence associated with that, then there's a place for you and it should be prison. However, to your point earlier, the efforts around rehabilitation are quite weak. The good thing here is with most of our people who are committing minor offenses, we're trying to divert. We divert about 1,000, I say kids because that's what they seem to me when they're in their 20s, but we divert about 1,000 young people a year to get them from getting that first conviction. And then the Urban League and some of our other partners will help them get the life skills and get them employed. So that's the, I think, a more thoughtful and long-term, a better approach to it.
Well, you call them kids, and maybe rightfully so, because we're now learning that at least with young men, their brains aren't fully, 25, 26 years old. They're not really, they're still making irrational decisions because their brains won't let them make any.
You're looking at one, Mike. You're looking at one.
And this program of diverting kids from crime really began under your predecessor. How effective has it been?
I think it's been quite effective. What we're seeing is about 86% of the people don't reoffend in that first year or so. We're very, very happy with the results. Yeah. What we're trying to do now is look at that under a longer period of time to make sure that it sticks. And the other thing is we're trying to make sure we get partners who are giving them life skills that can get them employed, because I want them to contribute to the tax base, give our officers more money, and help us to ensure the safety of the city. I think that's a much more thoughtful and long-term, a much better approach.
Well, that's one of the things that we kind of forgot, I think, in that get tough on crime period, is that most of these people are going to get out of prison
someday.
And if you get out of prison with no prospects, no ability to get a job because now you have a record, where else can you turn except to rob somebody's house to get money for food or whatever you need? Have we learned that lesson? Are we doing things to help people who have been incarcerated with justification find employment when they get out?
Well, reentry, there's some efforts, but they're just, I don't know that we're being as successful as we'd like to be. But to that point, in November, there are about 200 people getting out of federal custody who are going to be in this region. So ask me that question in December, Mike. Let's revisit it then.
Right.
But in all honesty, I think we're kind of weak there in the reentry area.
Stuart emails, why so many intimidating skinhead cops? They seem to enjoy the intimidation. How about a dress code that includes reasonable haircuts?
You know, Mike, that question, I don't know how to take that question because I'm shaved, not bald. So I don't know if I'd fall in the category
That's
of a skinhead.
But
again, we do have a pretty strict policy on appearance. And I think when you go bare, you never go back. So I'm good with having a shaved head. I think, though, what they're really talking about is people being overly intimidating and overly aggressive. And again, that's why we're educationally looking to change hearts and minds and hit people in the gut with the learning experience so they see the impact of that. And that's something that's going to take a while to change. But again, it's back to the point you made earlier, the culture of who we attract. Mm-hmm. We're trying to change that as well.
Just like any other job, when you were not the chief, I'm sure that you looked at some of the decisions that were being made and had maybe slightly different opinion about what should have been done and not be totally in sync with the people above you at the time. Well, now you're at the top. Now that you've been at the top for 16 days, were there policies that you were iffy on that you've come to realize that, hey, that was a good idea, that's what we should be doing?
Yes, one of which is when we start changing our recruitment philosophy, and I'm going to push that even further under my administration. But I tell you, when I was a deputy chief, I knew all the policies as soon as they were implemented that were bad. Now that I am chief, I have no clue. So what I've done is I've established a transition team that's going to later be my advisory council, and it's predominantly officers because that's who these policies impact. And they're starting to critique.
So when you say officers, these are the police people, the policemen on the streets?
Yes, yes, sir.
Not just the officers who sit in the office all day.
Correct. These are the heroes who do the work every day. And those are the people who are going to help me craft these policies and revisit a lot of policies that gave us some concern when we implemented them. We're going to assess them, and we're going to look to tweak them and make them a little bit stronger and more palatable, but practical and effective for the community. And that group is, I tell you, they give me more feedback than I ever wanted or needed, but it's helping us be better when we establish policies moving forward.
How long has it been since you've been on the street yourself?
Well, I did a walking beat yesterday, Tuesday. Does that count?
It counts.
Yes. I was on Bates Ford at LaSalle, walking around, talking to people. I was amazed at how well we were received. Yeah. A couple of us in the division captain walked, and what they told me very succinctly was, we want to see more of this, and I can assure them they will.
I was going to say, what's it say to them that the chief of police is on the beat?
Well, Mike, I want to develop from the bottom up, and I want to model the behavior I expect to see from our officers, and this is a step in that direction.
Marcel writes, we currently see marijuana decriminalization and legalization in different jurisdictions around the country. What is CMPD's and your position on minor marijuana infractions?
We're looking at that policy right now, Mike, to be quite frank with you, because there was a situation that happened with a very small amount of marijuana, and even though our actions were legal, we're trying to make sure we're doing the right thing for the right reasons in the right ways. And it is less of an issue for society, and therefore we have to adjust. I will tell you, though, 2 short years ago, 40% of our homicides were connected to weed trafficking. Mm-hmm. So there is our distinction. It's going to come down to the amount that we're talking about. But small personal use is not as much of a target as trafficking cases.
James in Charlotte says, please ask the chief if he has seen the gardenia video and how he processes what he saw. I'm not familiar with that.
I'm not familiar with that video, sir.
It takes time to transition into any new job, I suppose. Was your transition made easier because you were a deputy chief and you've been with the force for so long? It was like you just walked down the hall and changed desks.
I think so. I think, and we're still in transition along the desk part, Mike. Haven't really moved all my stuff yet. There's not a lot that I'm going to take with me. A lot of it needs to be thrown away. But yes, I think it was. I think a lot of the relationships were already there.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying, and it's humbling, is the people that I was working with as a deputy chief are really rallying around me and making us as an organization feel like we're supported. I just want our officers on the street to see more of that, not just me, because it matters more to them than me.
I was going to ask you that there were five deputy chiefs. You were among them. So now there were four deputy chiefs who didn't get the job.
Sure.
How has that been? How has that affected or impacted
Mike,
your relationship?
I thought we were going to start this conversation and we were going to be, you know, kind of amicable and it's going well. No, it's really going well. It's really going well. I got a great team of deputy chiefs, any of whom could have stepped in the spot. I was the one who really chased it.
Yeah.
I felt I was ready and I went after it. And, you know, to my benefit, others weren't as interested.
And they didn't go outside. Usually when anybody at any level of municipal government leaves, they go outside to find their replacement. At least they do a search. They may end up with somebody in-house. They didn't do the search. What does that say about CMPD and particularly about you?
What it says about the city leadership is they are brilliant. They saw talent, Mike. No, seriously, I think we're in good shape. I think Chief Monroe's bench was very strong. I really do. And I've been through national searches and even to the point of getting job offers and everything else. And I know how it leaves a bad taste in candidates' mouths when you're doing it just to say you did a national search. So I think this search was vigorous. Trust me, I did 416 interviews, it seems, with various people in the community. And I think I was thoroughly vetted. And I think we're going to do fine because of the team that we have.
You've been described as no-nonsense by some, by former Chief Monroe and your mother, as someone who should smile more. You smile a lot during this interview. And you describe yourself as an introvert. I only have 20 seconds left. Really, an introvert?
I know. It's amazing. I do okay for an introvert. I guess I'm totally inarticulate and can't have a cogent thought. But I think, to my mom's point, I am smiling more. I'm practicing, and I got a lot to smile about being here in Charlotte.
Chief Kerr Putney, the new chief of police for Charlotte-Mecklenburg. Hope to see you again. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, sir.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nantahala Outdoor Center, providing zip line adventures with 360-degree views of the Great Smoky Mountains. Information at noc.com. Millions of Americans regularly take over-the-counter medicines for minor aches and pains, but the FDA has now strengthened its warning that some of these drugs can be dangerous. So on the Diane Rehm Show at 20 minutes to 10 o'clock, they'll talk about the risks and the benefits of non-prescription pain relief medications. That's coming up next on WFAE. Charlotte Talks continues next with something you may not know very much about, urbexing or urban exploring. We'll get to that in a moment. Stay with us.
Your days are busy.
Work, school, errands, kids.
It never stops.
And the news never stops either.
You can keep up between Morning Edition and All Things Considered with Here and Now. Hi, it's Robin Young.
And Jeremy Hobson. Here and Now brings you breaking news, developing stories, the latest in the arts and innovation.
Asking tough questions, unpacking complex issues.
From across the country and around the world.
Join us 12 noon on Charlotte's NPR News Source, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. There is a form of photography known as urbex. That's short for urban exploration. And as is the case with most artistic works, the artists, in this case photographers, who are best at urbex can find strange beauty amidst the rubble of structural decay. Believe it or not, there are guidelines that most photographers follow if they want to fit into the urban exploration movement, and they put themselves in danger from time to time, both in terms of danger from the environments into which they insert themselves in order to take those photographs, but also the danger of being arrested for going where you're not supposed to go. Now, you've been sitting in the studio, Ryan. Well, the chief of police has been here. I think it's been very uncomfortable for you. Ryan Gusman is one of those people. He's been involved in this activity for several years, already has had some of his own work shown in galleries. He has two books of his work right here, and he joins us for the rest of the hour. Thank you for being here and braving the police chief.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, if you'd like to see some urban exploration photography done by Ryan, you can go to our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks. There's some images there, and you can also click on the links on our page to see additional images. Define urban exploration for me.
Urban exploration is a bit fun. You end up going into these buildings, the buildings that everybody looks at and has a draw to them, and you end up being like one day, well, I'm just going to go in this building, basically, and you end up wanting to take pictures and capturing the place, getting a general feel and understanding of how it was for the people who worked there and just the history of it, and has that draw to it.
And when you go into these buildings, do you go in because a window is broken or a door is left open, or do you actually kind of break in?
I will not be providing the specifics of that. This is not intended to be a walkthrough.
But you go into buildings that they really don't want people in, yeah. Obviously, either because it's public property or private property, or because there might be safety issues involved. You do put yourself in danger to put these in here. Not physical danger. You could fall down a hole that you don't see, or a beam could fall on you, right?
Yeah, I've fallen through floors before.
Why did this start for you? How did this start for you?
With me personally, I had a house when I lived in Florida. That was about 20-something years ago, though. Uh-huh. There was an abandoned house right up the road from me, and I ended up going in it when I was like 6 or 7. Not the brightest idea. And I had this draw to it, and I kind of forgot about that draw. And I moved to Winston-Salem, where I am now. And there's all these buildings. There's this draw to it. I didn't have that feeling again until I went to Winston-Salem and started seeing those buildings. And I was like, well, can I get in these buildings? Is it okay to get in these buildings? Is anybody going to let me in these buildings? And most of those questions were no when asked. So I was like, well, let's see what happens when I decide to go in. And
so ask for forgiveness, not permission.
That's pretty much how it is. But you also need to keep in mind there's a pretty big risk on both sides. It's pretty easy to ask for permission as opposed to the other one.
Well, you have been in situations where either police were in the general vicinity because maybe they knew somebody was in the building, or just because they were in the vicinity and you've had to evade them. Correct?
Yes. There was one instance out in High Point. There was a school. We'll not be providing the specific location, mm-hmm. unfortunately. That there was a police training exercise just by chance in that same building, and I was in it while they were doing that training with the dogs. So the dogs were like barking, being like, hey, there's somebody here. And the police were just ignoring it because they thought it was because they were training and doing the normal exercises. And at one point, I had to literally start following the walls and hiding, doing sneaky ninja stuff, for lack of a better word. And
how many people are there, do you think, who do what you do, either as a hobby or kind of professionally? Because I know a lot of people have seen the insides of buildings in Detroit, which the whole city is kind of an urban exploration bonanza. But I've seen so many of those pictures that we would never see had it not been for people like you. How many people like you are there out there?
It'd be hard to say. I don't have the facts like the police chief did earlier.
How many do you know?
I know quite a bunch. I will not give specifics on that.
You're playing this close to the vest, aren't you?
Well, yeah. There's certain guidelines.
Why so secretive? Because that's one of the things I read about this, that people who do what you do are very secretive about what they do.
Well, you got to remember, when it comes to these buildings, there's a very limited set of buildings. People see these abandoned buildings all the time and think, well, nobody's going to go in there, and if I talk about it, it won't be known. And if you talk about that building, you release that location, or you talk about the hobby more than you should, it ends up more people going to these buildings that will not respect them. And it ends up decaying even faster because people are going through, wrecking stuff where they shouldn't, going in, taking the copper out. There's all sorts of things on the back end that a lot of people do not realize going in.
You strike me, when I read about you and about others like you who do this and who take that approach, this respectful approach, all you want to do is go in and look around and document what you see.
Yeah.
You're almost approaching this like an archaeologist would a dig, a find. They don't want to destroy what they found, and they want to keep others out who don't understand the importance of preservation.
Yeah.
Where does that come from in you? Did you take archaeological training? Do other people like you do that? Seriously, because you're kind of an archaeologist with a camera.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. I've always had an appreciation of history and respecting and loving museums.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little upset I could never touch anything in the museums, even though I did anyway. But this isn't live, is it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I do kind of see myself as somebody who goes in and documents these places, and I try to, and a lot of other people do that as well. The ones that don't and they disrespect the location are usually just, I won't say banished, but they do not get any respect from us. We do not share locations, trade locations.
And so you don't really tell people where things are that you shoot. They can deduce it perhaps by looking at some of the pictures, but probably not. And you don't tell them because you don't want people to go in and destroy what's there. What's there should be left as it is.
Exactly.
Do you explore only publicly owned buildings or commercial buildings? Do you also explore abandoned houses, things that would be considered private property?
I do both.
So is what you do considered illegal? Is it trespassing in some cases? Would you be prosecuted? Could you be prosecuted?
It's definitely trespassing.
If you're not destroying, you're not taking things, you're leaving things as you found them, you're just taking pictures. So what would the charge be? Trespassing?
For the most part.
Have you ever been arrested? Have you been caught?
I have been caught. There have been a couple of times where I've had to explain myself. The cops come out, and then they see that I'm carrying all the stuff, and they're like, well, you've been nice, and you've talked with us, and you told us what you were doing.
Now get out.
Basically, you're stupid. Get out. Why are you in these buildings?
Yeah. So you're carrying what, lighting equipment?
I do not carry lighting equipment. Just as the way I shoot, I hate artificial light.
Okay.
I need natural light. But that's not the question. I carry a full kit. I will not be giving the kit details because that'd be a how-to for people who think they want to do this. So,
it's more than an iPhone.
It's definitely more than an iPhone. I would like to say people have had to babysit in a building before who only bring their phone. And they never come with me again. Let's just put it like that.
Okay. So now, what attracts you? How do you choose the places that you investigate with your camera?
They kind of choose you. I don't really go out and like seek them. I'll be driving around and seeing these buildings, and suddenly there'll just be maybe an energy. I'm not entirely sure how to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that clicks in your brain. I'm like, well, maybe I'll try this today. And there's been a few buildings where I've actually actively sought after, but not very many. I could list some, but I won't.
People like you, what walks of life do they come from? What's their average age? Are they mostly young people? Are they all ages?
Well, just as a nature of the hobby, we do not deal with people under 18. just because having a minor with you makes things a little bit more complicated than they should. But for the most part, I would say our average age is around 35, 30s, maybe mid-20s. Most of the people I've encountered in the hobby have been in that age group from 25 all the way up to 58, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I know of other explorers who are well in their 60s that have been doing this as well.
Do you consider yourself a documentary photographer, an art photographer? How do you think of yourself?
I'm still having problems answering that one myself. I just really like the buildings, and people really like how I shoot. So I guess maybe an art photographer. A lot of these buildings I've been in as well have been demolished or renovated, and I guess in that aspect I am documenting them.
How do you think of your own work? I mean, when you look at the picture, because they're really very well done. I'm looking through two books of pictures that you've taken. They're really interesting.
Thanks.
And you're using only natural light.
Yes.
And it's artful.
Thanks. I don't know exactly what I'm doing sometimes. I have no training with cameras. I literally picked up a DSLR 2 years ago and started shooting with it with no training, and I shoot exclusively manual, that type of thing. And I just taught myself, basically, and that's how it kind of turned out.
As I look through this, a lot of these are interior shots of buildings that are in a woeful state. They've been abandoned for quite a while, but the paint is peeling off the walls. There are cigarette packs left behind on the floor, maybe salary cards and things like left behind. These are places that used to be teeming with life, with people.
Yeah.
Now they're not only empty, they are abandoned and left to decay. What kind of a feeling do you get when you're in the buildings, and do you think your photographs capture that feeling?
Every time I go in those buildings, I just make it a point to try to get a general feeling of the building. When I shoot, part of the reason why you don't see a filter in any of my pictures is because I try to get how it feels to be in there naturally, just as is, as if you're the person in there. And with that, I try to capture the decay, how it felt, maybe the history of the building. If there's anything left, usually it's all scrapped by the time I get in there. The scrappers have come in and sold whatever can be sold or smashed whatever can be smashed. But in those places, I try to capture the historic, the feel, the people who used to work there, live there, that type of thing, all while showing you that this is what's become of it. And on that, I've actually encountered people who've lived in the places, worked in the buildings. Like, for instance, I will be providing this location, the R.J. Reynolds building, which is currently being renovated in Winston-Salem. I was able to get in there before they gutted it and get pictures of the entire thing. And I had one of the board members come in and was like, I'm glad somebody went in here and took these pictures, because nobody... It appears that nobody has gone in and taken these pictures and documented this building, which, I mean, if you know Winston-Salem and the R.J. Reynolds ties, they literally made that city.
Oh,
there.
Sure.
And there isn't much documenting that one building before they took it out, and they really appreciated
and
that.
And they renovated the building. They didn't tear it down, right?
They did not tear it down.
These are the kind of photographs that would be nice to have in the building.
Yeah, it's pretty tricky thing there. I've actually had buildings that have been renovated come after my work and say, hey, well, we want to go ahead and buy it.
I mentioned employee salary cards because I was looking at a picture here that you've taken of an employee salary card.
Look at the dates as well.
Let me see if I can find a date. Oh, my goodness, 1920.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So these are handwritten ledger salary cards.
Yeah.
You've been through, and you and others who do this urban exploration have gone through and found all kinds of documentation. You have found, maybe not you, but others have found, customer records, medical records. Some of these records have people's individual social security numbers on them. These were left behind when the buildings were abandoned and people moved out. When you find things like that, maybe contemporary records with social security numbers on them, do you alert authorities? Do you turn the material over to somebody? Or do you just leave it where you found it and ignore it? Because it seems to me that puts people in danger.
I've never actually considered that perspective. It's nice that you actually brought that to my attention. That's going to change my perspective a little bit. I would ignore it personally. I didn't actually think on those numbers being an issue. But now that you mention it, that's one perspective that I definitely am going to start thinking on. Because I have actually encountered like corporation health records where they've gone through and found out that a lot of their employees got cancer for something they did. And I didn't, the social security numbers would be on their medical records, their history, all that would be all nicely organized in a cabinet somewhere. And I mean, I wouldn't know what to do with that. I wouldn't know if I should report it or how to report it.
That would be a problem, how to report it. But but obviously, if you have access to it and you're leaving it behind, you're not doing anybody harm, but somebody could go in there and harvest the numbers.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel like it's in some cases that you've found materials that have been hidden from employees?
I have, actually. There was one instance in a furniture factory. I won't be given the location, unfortunately.
Of course not.
But I actually went through and found out that the corporation was specifically saying that hearing damage is not a thing, you're fine. And I encountered 3 cabinets full of medical records of people who went deaf. And the company was like, well, it was just an accident. So.
Joe writes, does your work reveal a sort of romantic quality to something ruined? Do you consider yourself a storyteller? Do you have a nostalgic or hopeful feeling about these places?
I hold both nostalgic outlook and a hopeful outlook. I'm trying, it's a weird balance, but with that, it basically ends up that I'm hoping these buildings end up getting renovated or being reused.
You can find your work mostly to Winston, where you're from.
Yes.
Are you going to spread out very quickly?
I'm intending to.
Okay. We won't know where until we find... Where do we find your pictures aside from our website this morning?
I have... on Instagram, my handle is Urban Mess. So if you want to find me on that, you can. My imager handle is UENC.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan. I appreciate it. Ryan Gussman, an urbexer.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.